Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
What fires are stoking the burn? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is a special edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a profile of Bernie Sanders, U.S. Senator and presidential candidate. He's nothing if not consistent. From college days in Chicago to Capitol Hill to this year's campaign, he's pursued a single goal.
An economy that works for working families, not just the billionaire class.
Despite socialist leaning, Sanders has worked with Republicans in the Senate. As mayor of Burlington, Vermont, he was praised for fiscal efficiency. Biographers, old friends, and former staffers will tell us how a very private man has made himself one of this year's most important public figures. Today's talking point, America's culture wars, who always wins, who always loses. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with a special edition of To the Point, a profile of U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. With Hillary Clinton feeling the heat, what fires are stoking the burn? Harry Jaffe is author of the unauthorized biography, Why Bernie Sanders Matters. Harry Jaffe, great to have you on our program.
I'm excited to be with you again, and pretty exciting all of a sudden, don't you think?
Well, it certainly is. Now, we all know that he is, of course, that he matters because he's a real challenger for the presidential nomination. But go beneath that and tell us, according to your unauthorized biography, why does he matter?
Well, I think that he is someone who, over the years in his political career, has basically spoken the truth as he sees it. It's kind of unvarnished. It's worked for him for 40 years. Certainly, it's built a brand in Vermont. And so he doesn't have to, as they say, gild a lily. He doesn't have to listen to polls. He doesn't have to listen to handlers. Bernie Sanders believes that income inequality is the biggest problem facing this country. He has been saying that literally since the 1970s, that the wealthy are too wealthy, the poor are too poor, and the middle class is struggling. So I think that he matters because he's straightforward, and that's one of the things that appeals to people.
He learned this growing up in the tenements of Brooklyn, New York. Tell us about his early life.
Well, he grew up in a Brooklyn community that was decidedly Jewish and very close-knit. There were Jewish tailors, Jewish butchers, Jewish cafes, and it was a very left-wing, I would say, Marxist, communist, socialist brew of intellectuals who came from Germany and came from Russia, and they were instilled with this sense of social good. And Sanders himself grew up in a two-room a tenement with his parents and his brother. They struggled financially. His father sold paint. I'm not so sure exactly whether that means he sold it in a store or sold it on the road. They never had enough money. He was very close to his mother. His mother wanted one thing. She wanted to move out of the tenement and have a house of her own. She died before she could fulfill that dream. And I think that that's marked Sanders for the rest of his life.
Interesting you say that you're not sure if his father sold paint in one way or another or had a store. Yours is an unauthorized biography, and I take it that he is a very private man.
Well, he's very different than any other politician that we've come across, because he is not someone who wants to parade around his tough beginnings and get close to the voters and get close to the people by sharing. He doesn't share. He's not interested in that. Barack Obama has a couple of autobiographies out. Hillary Clinton has one. You name a politician, they'll tell you their story. Sanders, he's not that interested. He thinks it takes away from the more important work of getting the people's work done, of reorganizing society, of studying the numbers, of getting the word out. You know, Bernie Sanders doesn't have time to talk about himself. That's how he approaches journalists.
Tell us how he took his Bush experience growing up in Brooklyn to the University of Chicago and what he did there.
Well, he was not at all an activist in high school. He was an athlete. He was a long-distance runner. His dream in high school at James Madison High was to play basketball. And he didn't make the varsity team, and that's a big disappointment for him. But he did have this sense, especially from his older brother Larry, that there was a larger world and that that matters such as politics and socialism did make a difference. He gets to University of Chicago in 1961, and it's the dawn of the Civil Rights Movement. It's the dawn of the anti-Vietnam War movement. And he basically comes alive on the streets of Hyde Park, as opposed to coming alive in the classroom. He readily says that he almost flunked out of University of Chicago, that he got his education in the library, not in the classroom, on the streets, not in a classroom. And he led demonstrations. He led sit-ins. He demonstrated against, for instance, housing discrimination against black students. He was very big into the free love movement. So he really blossomed as an activist in Chicago in the early 60s.
Okay. So he then in Chicago represented a number of different issues that are still relevant today.
Absolutely. I mean, one in particular, the Chicago Defender, which is an African-American newspaper in Chicago, published a photograph of a young woman getting her arm bent behind her by a white cop. His group, the Congress of Racial Equality, copied that photograph onto a poster to advertise a demonstration against police brutality. This is in 1962. As Sanders tells it, he was walking down the street, putting these posters up on poles. He's followed by a police car, Chicago police car. The police are ripping down every single poster that he puts up. And then he gets confronted by a cop who says, you know, points his finger in his face and says, it's people like you who come from outside who are making trouble here. The races got along just fine before you showed up.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with this portrait of Bernie Sanders on To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're not only back with To the Point in this profile of U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. We've been talking with Harry Jaffe, author of the unauthorized biography, Why Bernie Sanders Matters. And he's taken us from Brooklyn to the University of Chicago, where Bernie Sanders came awake on the streets, as it were, during the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam movement. We've just heard how he, in fact, advocated on behalf of black people subjected to police brutality. We'll come back to his early life in a moment, but I want to take him to the next phase when he became the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. Scott McKay is a political analyst now for Rhode Island Public Radio. He's a former reporter for the Burlington Free Press. And Scott, thank you very much for joining our program.
It's great to be with you folks.
Say hello
to my old friend Harry.
Okay, well, Harry can hear you. And we're glad you guys are both on our program. Now, tell us about how it was that Bernie Sanders came to Vermont and then got elected as mayor What kind of mayor he was?
He was a pretty good mayor, but let's go back to how he first won. This was absolutely an improbable election. It was a three-way race, which helped him, but really what happened in Vermont was, in Burlington, the state's largest city, it's really just an overgrown college town. Even today, there's only about 42,000 people who live there. But what happened was the Democratic machine that had run the town for so many years, basically an unwary kind of amalgam of Irish Catholic and French Canadian immigrants, had grown so rusty that they couldn't steal a 10-vote election. And I'll never forget that night as long as I live. The hierarchy of the Democratic Party in town, all these guys, and they were all guys in those days, were upstairs in a bar called Nectar's on Main Street, and they were just celebrating what they thought was going to be the last hurrah of a guy named Gordon Paquette, this old, real inside kind of traditional pal that you'd see during the election. He wouldn't call him Sanders. He kept calling him Saunders. And, of course, Bernie Sanders went door-to-door, really worked hard. And Paquette and these guys, they just didn't take him seriously. They didn't think that this guy who'd been running as an anti-war candidate, viewed as a fringe figure in Vermont, had any chance at all of being elected mayor of Burlington. And so what Sanders did was put together this great organization of young people. It's a college town, as you probably know. Was really able to galvanize people who hadn't had a voice at all in City Hall for years. And sure enough, on election night, they were stunned when this thing came back, 10 votes for Sanders. And while they were partying, one of Bernie Sanders' young acolytes, a lawyer, then a public defender named John Franco, was smart enough to wake a judge up, a Superior Court judge named Ed Amidon, and seal the ballots. Get the sheriffs in the county around Burlington called Chittenden County to seal these ballots. So pretty soon, these guys, they didn't know how to steal this thing. This was getting really out of control, and that's how Sanders won.
Let me go back to Harry Jaffe briefly. How was it that this guy from Brooklyn, who was the civil rights and anti-Vietnam demonstrator in Chicago, ended up in Burlington, Vermont, with 40,000 people today, and the kind of government we just heard described?
Well, as the story goes, he was in Manhattan one day with his older brother Larry, 8 years his senior, and they passed by a booth that was advertising cheap land in this glorious state of Vermont, and I think that just, he just tucked that away in his head as something he'd like to do. Graduates from University of Chicago, and he's kind of at loose ends. He's actually married, briefly, I might say, and he and his brother go on a trip. They meet up in Europe, and then they decide to go to Israel. And in Israel, Bernie Sanders spends about 6 months on a kibbutz, which is an agrarian, communal lifestyle where people join together to grow food, to make decisions, to take care of the children. It's kind of socialistic in a way, if you will. And Sanders does that. It makes a huge impact on him. I know this from his brother, not from him, because, you know, Sanders didn't talk to me. But he comes back to the United States, and he winds up going to Brooklyn, I'm sorry, to Vermont for a few months at a time and buys some property outside of Montpelier and realizes that he likes that lifestyle. And he moves up there permanently, in part because he really didn't have much of anything else, you know, in line to do. And when he goes up there, he first lives on some land outside of Montpelier. Then he moves up to what we call the Northeast Kingdom, which is kind of more removed and a little more barren. He doesn't really make it in either place, and he gravitates to what in Vermont passes as an urban area, the city of 40,000. So he didn't have any great plan in life. He just showed up because he had friends in Burlington.
All right. Got back to Scott McKay again, who covered him with the Burlington Free Press, and you indicated how he got elected by 10 votes. And there were, of course, not just Democrats trying to steal the election back, but Republicans in Burlington as well. How did he get along as mayor with people who were suddenly confronted with this hippie-looking guy from Chicago and Brooklyn?
Well, at the start, it was what we call in Rhode Island a frittata. It was just a mess. The Democrats especially were very, very, very upset about this. They thought this was a fluke and he'd only be mayor for a couple of years. They wouldn't let him hire anybody. Didn't even want to let him hire a secretary. The city council, basically, it was really crazy. One of the city councilors, a woman named Joyce Desitel, got up and said that the Democrats in town had to fight this socialist fungus that had taken over Burlington. And, of course, the young Bernie Sanders supporters got up and started a chant, fungus among us, fungus among us. It became kind of their rallying cry, a little bit of guerrilla street theater. However, the Republicans, a lot of them were old, waspy New England Republican moderates, and a lot of them really didn't like this French-Irish machine that had run the town for years and years. There were the old kind of Republicans. We don't have them really as many anymore. There's a few left in New England, but if you look at the National Republican Party, it's nothing like it used to be. We used to call these folks like Rockefeller Republicans. They were people with names like Gear, Wadhams, Patterson. They were basically Protestant good government types. And it was interesting that Sanders was able to run the city by forging relationships with these people. And basically what he did was very pragmatic in his first couple of terms. The infrastructure in Burlington had been really neglected for many, many years. One of the big issues, this happens not in California, but in the Northeast. Administrations that don't do a good job with snow removal, boy, the mayors really hear it. And the previous regime hadn't done a good job with that. And Sanders had pledged during his campaign that he was going to clean the sidewalks and do a better job plowing the streets. And sure enough, when he came in, he did.
And I understand he was known as a fiscal conservative. He insisted on competitive bidding at a time when they weren't doing competitive bidding. There's nothing very socialistic about that.
They used to have all kinds of deals going on. People, one of the state senators who was influential in the party had a summer home that I found as a young reporter was financed on the city cemetery commission. It was typical of a small town machine where, you know, if you knew somebody, they'd take care of you, got taken care of. A lot of patronage, a lot of city jobs handed out to people who were underwhelming, less than qualified, whatever you want to say, but they were probably somebody's cousin.
And then he was in his fourth term, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have to get so much information here. In his fourth term, U.S. News and World Report said he was one of the top 20 mayors in the country.
Yes, and if you look at Burlington today, you'll see some of the legacy of what he did. One of the things, this was kind of a sleepy New England college town, and one of the things he did was bring in a real efflorescence for the arts and became a magnet city for young people. And he pushed affordable housing. He kept this pristine Lake Champlain waterfront open, mostly public land, and the other regime had wanted to put in, you know, high-priced condos along the lake. And it was very unpopular with people, and Sanders really glommed onto that.
Okay.
Expanded the bike path. Those kinds of things. And in Vermont, people just love the environment up there. And the other thing he did was infrastructure. If you look at how he fixed the streets, you drive today in downtown Burlington, you'll be very surprised at how good a shape their infrastructure's in. He also was able to push through a bond issue that separated the combined sewer systems in town. The street drains and the regular sewers, and was able to separate them, which was immeasurable in helping to clean up Lake Champlain, which is a real treasure up there. So in that case, as he was forward-looking, he also hired very good, smart people.
Okay, on that note, let me introduce one of the people that he hired. Chris Pearson is now a representative in the legislature in the state of Vermont. He was a staffer for Bernie Sanders. Before that, Chris Pearson, it's great to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how you went to a party at Bernie Sanders' house, and he was vacuuming the living room floor?
Well, this was when I worked for him, and we were hosting a small brunch gathering. And, you know, I was a kid of 25 at the time. I remember walking in the front door and being sort of getting a chuckle at the congressman feverishly vacuuming. But, you know, he pitched in as we all got the house ready for whatever it was, a Sunday brunch event of some kind. He's very much a hands-on guy and very down-to-earth, so looking back, it doesn't seem so remarkable, but something about it tickled me at the time.
We heard earlier that he's a very private person. He wouldn't talk to Harry Jaffe, who was trying to write a biography, which turned out to be very favorable. What was he like to work with? What was he like to deal with on a personal basis?
He's a wonderful guy, very serious, certainly. Wouldn't spend a lot of time on small talk, but I've grown very fond of him. He's a very compassionate guy. Folks, listeners would have seen a video maybe in the last few weeks where somebody fainted at a press conference Bernie was holding, and he runs right from the podium towards that guy, deeply, obviously concerned about the man. You know, it's very much who he is. I spent a couple of years driving around the state with him. Usually I would drive, but sometimes Bernie felt like driving, and it was a great glimpse at the kind of guy he was. He loves being out and talking to Vermonters. He loved stopping at farm stands and buying fresh tomatoes and even swimming holes. He has a fondness for swimming holes after a day of marching in a parade. One day he brought me a pair of swim trunks because he couldn't reach me before he was picking me up. He said, "Chris, do you like to swim? We're going to great swimming holes today." You know, so it was a lot of fun. Certainly a very serious guy, works very, very hard, and always thinking about Vermonters as our now senator, and working, really thinking about working people and middle-class
right.
people. It's very, very genuine when he talks about that from the podium.
Did he then, does he now, have a socialist agenda?
Well, I mean, he has a middle-class agenda. Some people want to call that socialist. You know, FDR had a similar agenda, I guess you could say. He has an agenda about helping average people. You know, I guess anyone who's fighting for the 99% has something of a socialist agenda, so maybe that includes Bernie.
Let me introduce Michael Cohen just before we go to the break to get a different voice in here. He is a columnist for the Boston Globe, a longtime student of Bernie Sanders, as our the guests are as well. And Michael Cohen, great to have you on our program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
We've heard that Bernie Sanders was, as mayor, pragmatic, that he was fiscally conservative, that he managed to leave a legacy having to do with the arts and the infrastructure. He got the sewers fixed up and was able to clear the streets of the snow. What about the proposals he's making as a presidential candidate as he tries to translate to his lifelong goals into the White House? Do you think that he is making that he's a serious candidate, that he's somebody who's worthy of the job?
Well, I mean, that's I guess something I guess for the voters to decide. But it comes to the seriousness of his candidacy. You know, it's hard not to look at what he's proposing and raise some, you know, serious questions. A lot of the ideas that he's putting forward are, they may be good ideas. People may agree with them, or they may not, like single payer health care or free college education. But getting them passed through Congress is something else altogether. And I think one of the things, sort of, I think it's problems with Sanders' policy proposals. I think they're not totally realistic, and they're not terribly in line with not just the country, but even the Democratic Party, and certainly Democrats in Congress. And I think in general, one of the problems I see with Sanders' campaign is that he basically has made money as sort of the end-all be-all of American politics, and money in his view seems to be the biggest problem in politics today, which he says all the time. And I would argue, you know, that as a progressive, you know, Sanders should perhaps aim his glare elsewhere, and that's toward Republicans. I mean, the people who have been holding up reform over the past 7 or 8 years have not been big money interests, although there's some of that clearly, but it's been Republicans. And you see this week with the Scalia death, that Republicans immediately said, we're not going to push forward with Supreme Court justice. This wasn't because of Wall Street, wasn't because of big donors. It was because, you know, of ideology, because of politics. And so one of the issues, I think, with Sanders' entire sort of frame and when he talks about politics is he makes everything sort of about money and inequality, but politics doesn't actually work in such a linear fashion.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break. Sorry to interrupt you, but in the interest of time, I have no choice. We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue this conversation on our talking point in a few minutes. We'll talk about America's culture wars and how they go back to the beginning. Who always wins? Who always loses? We'll hear an interesting theory about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Talk today about Bernie Sanders, now a senator, now, of course, running for president of the United States of America, a man who came through the University of Chicago, became an anti-war demonstrator, a civil rights demonstrator, moved to Burlington, Vermont, for rather personal reasons, became the mayor, was not taken seriously at all, either before the election or for a long time after the election, but ended up, as we've heard, a very pragmatic mayor, one who was able to govern in a way that was satisfactory to both political parties, Republican and Democrat, and who left a considerable legacy. Now we're hearing, though, from Michael Cohen, who says his issues that he's using as he's running for president of the United States aren't really realistic, that in fact, pardon me, he's talking all about money, when in fact what really is at stake here is to a greater extent ideology. So Michael Cohen, back to you, columnist for the Boston Globe. What about that early experience, and is it possible that you might be taking him not as seriously as he deserves?
Well, to me, this isn't even so much about Bernie Sanders. It's much more about the nature of our political system today, which has become sort of a parliamentary system into an American government. And we basically have a situation now in which the two parties are so polarized between each other, where there's just no middle ground, where no politician, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, whoever else, on the Democratic side, I think can convince Republicans to sort of see things their way. And to some extent, for Sanders to aim his attacks on Wall Street and on money, it's a way of attacking his opponent, Hillary Clinton, but it's also a way of sort of arguing the whole political system is corrupted. But I don't think that all Democrats basically feel that way, or I don't think it's actually accurate. I think for Democrats, the biggest problem they've dealt with in the past 7 years is that they is an extreme obstructionist Republican Party that doesn't not interested in compromise, not interested in bipartisanship. And so, you know, this has nothing to do with Bernie Sanders per se. I think it has to do more with the nature of our political system today. And the question is who, you know, the Democratic Party is best equipped not just to deal with it, but actually to get elected. Because really what this election comes down to in many ways is who's in the Oval Office on January 20th, 2017. And that really, to me, is sort of the most important issue that I think Democratic voters should be thinking about.
Given the people who have responded to him so warmly, so that we refer to the burn, do you think that he's creating false expectations?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. And all politicians create false expectations. I mean, it's sort of the nature of the business to some extent. But I think Sanders is really creating false expectations, more so when you talk about doing a single payer, talking about wiping money out of politics, talking about political revolution. I mean, I don't think any of this is remotely possible. And I think it sort of misjudges, again, this polarization in the political system today, which to me, in my view at least, is much more important and much more telling about where we are in politics today than Wall Street and money and big pocketed contributors.
Michael Cohen, again, columnist for the Boston Globe. Let me introduce somebody who has made hundreds of calls on behalf of Bernie Sanders. He is currently in Queensland, Australia, where he's a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for the History of Emotions at the University of Queensland. He's a former member of the International Socialist Organization, but once again, he is a major supporter of Bernie Sanders as his candidate for president. Spencer Jackson, welcome to you.
Yes, good to be with you, Warren.
What do you say to Michael Cohen and his analysis of what's going on and how, in a certain sense, Bernie Sanders is missing the point?
I would respond that Michael Cohen has just offered a nice kind of apologia for the Democratic Party. I think part of my excitement and the broad excitement for Bernie Sanders is he's offering a very different vision. The Democratic Party is the party that passed deregulation of Wall Street it's the party that gutted welfare, but has attacked our social safety net in America. It's maintained an incredibly low tax rate globally on the richest members of society. And I think there is a consensus in America between Republicans and Democrats around a radically unequal system. And that inequality has been growing in the past 30 years, and it's grown regardless of whether we've been under a Republican or Democratic administration. And I think Bernie Sanders is offering the first glimmer of hope that we've had in a long time to seriously tackle this issue.
What if he can't win?
Well, I mean, to address the idea of false expectations or the supposed lack of realism in Bernie's campaign, I think that these so-called false expectations are political ideas. This is the essence of politics, is to fight for a set of ideas that one believes in. And the idea that politics can be predicted in advance or that we should only go after what is probable, you know, for more than just socialists, really many political liberal thinkers, that's a bad definition of politics. Politics is about what seems improbable becoming reality. That's been true of every major social reform in America.
Let me go back to Michael Cohen, a columnist at the Boston Globe. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I couldn't disagree more with what Mr. Jackson just said. I mean, first of all, it's simply not correct to say that Democrats are shredding the social safety net, certainly in comparison to what Republicans would do to the social safety net if given the opportunity. I mean, to me, the big question here is the differences that one might see between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think they're actually pretty narrow by and large. But even if one thinks they are, you know, bigger than I do, the differences between Republicans and the Democratic Party are so much wider and so much bigger. I mean, you talk about regulating Wall Street. You know, whether you think Dodd-Frank is an adequate reform, it is a reform that actually creates a mechanism for breaking up banks if necessary. There's no chance, absolutely no chance, the Republican Party would pass a similar reform, or if given the opportunity, they probably would repeal that reform. The differences here are incredibly stark. The difference between Roe v. Wade being the law of the land and abortion being outlawed, the differences between same-sex marriage being the law of the land and also, again, not being allowed. So I don't disagree with Bernie Sanders' reasons for running. I don't disagree with the issues he's raising. I think it's very important what he's doing. But we should sort of step back and be realistic about this and sort of say, look, it's important to talk about inequality. It's important to talk about the influence of money. But if you're a progressive, if you're a Democrat, the real issue you should be thinking about is who's going to be president, who's going to appoint that next Supreme Court justice if, as I assume, Republicans block President Obama from making a replacement pick in the next 11 months. That's the question you should be asking yourself, because that actually matters a lot more than whose health care plan is better. Because realistically, neither Clinton's nor Sanders' health care plan is going to become law, but the next president will pick the next Supreme Court justice.
Well, what if it were Bernie Sanders then? Let me ask you the reverse of the question I asked Dr. Spencer, Dr. Jackson. What if he won?
I mean, if he won, fine. If he won, that's great. I mean, good for him. I think the issue for Democrats to ask themselves is who's more likely to win in November. You may decide that you think Bernie Sanders is more likely to win than Hillary Clinton. That's fine. I mean, everyone's welcome to their views, certainly. But to me, that's the main question you should be asking yourself, much more so than who has a better plan to regulate Wall Street, who has a better plan to deal with health care. And ordinarily, I wouldn't say this. I think in many elections, those things do matter. But when you're dealing right now in a period of such polarization in American politics, when the difference between the two parties are so stark, I do think what matters a lot more is who has a better chance of winning in November, who's a better chance of mobilizing Democratic voters. And to me, that should be, for Democrats, I think at least, the number one issue.
So, Spencer Jackson, back to you. Would Democrats then be throwing their votes away if they voted for Bernie Sanders?
No. And I do think that an important part of Bernie Sanders' run here is reintroducing, really, because I think Obama's campaign did this as well, introducing a movement-based approach to politics. I think a great mistake that Obama made once he came into office was to dismantle the grassroots network that he constructed to get elected, which he could have used to push for his legislation. And I think Bernie Sanders is vowing to keep that network into place. What he means by a political revolution is getting people involved in the political system and keeping them involved so that what seems impossible, what seems improbable, can become a reality. And I do think there are differences between the Democratic and Republican Party. I think Michael's right on that front. But I think that there is an important issue, a central issue that's been left out of both parties. And that is the rising economic inequality, which is affecting all Americans. And these are millions of American people we're talking about.
Okay. Let me go back to the profile of Senator Sanders and the unauthorized biographer, Harry Jaffe. Once again, he's written the book called Why Bernie Sanders Matters. Was Bernie Sanders ever a hardcore socialist? He refers to himself as a democratic socialist. Has there been some sort of evolution?
Absolutely. I think that if you look back when he was in Chicago, he was a member of IPSL, the Young People's Socialist League. He was, even when he was in Vermont, running as this for statewide office with the Liberty Union Party. He was also a member of the Socialist Workers Party. One of the leaders of that party, Peter Diamondstone, told me that Sanders wanted to be a delegate in the 1980 Socialist Workers Party convention, and that Sanders came to Diamondstone and said, "Can you please get me a spot?" And Diamondstone could not. He failed. But I think that there were times at which Sanders very much was, what might be called closer to a doctrinaire socialist. And the fault line is, do you believe in the public ownership of the utilities, major corporations? If you notice, Chavez in Venezuela took over the oil companies, for instance. I think that Sanders left that behind pretty much in 1980 and 81. Once he became an elected mayor, he quit talking about socialism, and it was Scott McKay, who's with us today, who actually said, by the way, this guy's a socialist, which then brought all kinds of journalists to Vermont to find, the red mayor in the Green Mountains. And he's basically stepped slowly but surely away from socialism since those days.
Okay, and Scott McKay is still with us, as you indicated. He's now a political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio. He's reported for the Burlington Free Press when Bernie Sanders was mayor there. You can respond in any way to what we just heard, but let me also ask you about Bernie Sanders in 1985. He went to Nicaragua to visit the Sandinistas, who had won power in that country vastly against the wishes of the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. Can't you see in a Republican campaign against Bernie Sanders pictures of him in Managua, Nicaragua?
Yeah, I'm sure that they'll throw a lot of try to red bait him as much as possible, but he's always been against the interventionist, what he sees as an interventionist regime change type of American foreign policy, the very aggressive foreign policy we've seen. He talk about Mossadegh, he talk about the Central American incursions in Nicaragua and things over the years, and that's basically where he comes from. I will say I agree with Harry on the evolution aspect of all this. Bernie Sanders has been in Washington in Congress since 1991. If you check his Senate voting record, it's going to look an awful lot like Barbara Boxer's. It's going to look an awful lot like Jack Reed, a senior Democrat here from Rhode Island, who I deal with, and even Patrick Leahy, the leading Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, who's his brother senator from Vermont. So I'll never forget one time in the 80s when he was, the 90s when he was still in the House and Tom Foley was Speaker. A friend of mine was speechwriter at those days for Tom Foley. They talked about Bernie Sanders. What's this guy, this independent, this radical, and everything? And Foley told my friend, he said, that Bernie Sanders, he's a better Democrat than most of the Democrats I've got.
So, Michael Cohen, back to you with the Boston Globe. Should he then be emphasizing that record rather than sounding sort of one note when it comes to the issue of the economy and income inequality?
I mean, I actually would kind of say no. And I say that because I think what Sanders is bringing to the table in this election that is actually really useful is he is talking about issues like income inequality, talking about the role of money in politics, even if he's overstating it, that are important to have out there. And I think, you know, my view on Sanders from the beginning has been that it's important for political parties to have these kind of debates. He's raising important issues. But I fundamentally view him as a protest candidate. I don't view him as somebody who is prepared to be president. And that's, by the way, not just because of his domestic policy views, but mainly because of his foreign policy views, in which he appears to have very little foreign policy experience or even understanding of foreign policy. But I think it's great he's doing this. I just think people should be realistic about what it means. And it's hard to separate those two, I understand. But, you know, this is somebody who is a one-note candidate. And you know, Hillary Clinton says he's a single-issue candidate, and she's kind of right about that. I mean, this is his issue is income inequality and money in politics, and it's fine for him to talk about it. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that that makes somebody prepared to be president or makes them the best person to face off against Republicans in November.
Well, let me go back to Chris Pearson once again, now a representative of the legislature in Vermont, formerly a staff member of Bernie Sanders. When he was in Vermont, you have certainly been involved in trying to get him to run for president. Why do you think that he is qualified, given what we have heard just now?
Well, let's talk about who can win. I mean, in head-to-head polls against the leading Republicans, Bernie consistently does better, in fact, than Hillary Clinton. Just a few weeks ago in New Hampshire, you saw Bernie get over 2,000 write-in votes in the Republican primary. He got about 2% of what Donald Trump's vote total was from New Hampshire Republicans. And you see that across Vermont over and over, a crossover where conservative Vermonters vote for Bernie. I remember one time being up in the Northeast Kingdom and a working class guy comes up to us and says, you know, Bernie, I disagree with you on just about everything. And I vote for you every time. And Bernie says, why? And the guy says, I know just where you stand. These other people, I don't have a clue. And Bernie can resonate with all sorts of people. You know, I think most voters recognize that the political process is a negotiation. And you want to, people support Bernie because you want someone strong in their negotiating. It's not about him walking in and getting single-payer health care as a right for everybody on day one. It's about him negotiating from a strong position. And, you know, some of the comments have said, well, we're way too polarized to elect somebody like Bernie. The question voters are asking is, how do we change that dynamic? And part of the way you change it is you elect somebody who is unflinching, who's very brave and courageous and steadfast in their views. And you look at Bernie's record from 1994 to 2006 in the House, he passed more amendments than any other member of Congress. He's very good at being pragmatic, at finding openings here and there. And I believe many people support him because he will change the discussion, and we badly need to do that in Washington.
All right. We're going to end this profile of Bernie Sanders with a supporter, Chris Pearson, formerly on the staff of Bernie Sanders, himself now a representative in the Vermont State Legislature. Many thanks to you. Harry Jaffe, author of the unauthorized biography, Why Bernie Sanders Matters. Scott McKay, now political analyst at the Rhode Island Public Radio, former reporter for the Burlington Free Press when Bernie Sanders was mayor. Michael Cohen, columnist for the Boston Globe, has some concerns about the Sanders campaign. Spencer Jackson, again speaking to us from Queensland, Australia, but he's been on the phone for Bernie Sanders, and he is a big supporter. Thank you all very much for being on our program and giving our listeners a lot to think about as they decide where to vote, if they are Democrats, obviously, and where to vote if he, in fact, makes the general election. Great to have you all on our program. In a moment, America's culture wars go back to the beginning. Who always wins? Who always loses? Back in a moment with today's talking point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Well, we're only here with today's talking point. The nasty rhetoric of this year's presidential nominating campaigns is mild stuff compared to what John Adams and Thomas Jefferson said about each other in the campaign of 1880. Jefferson was even accused of being a secret Jew or a Muslim, anticipating what's been whispered about Barack Obama. When they become political, America's culture wars take on a pattern. That's according to Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University, author of Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars, Even When They Lose Elections. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Why do we keep having culture wars in the United States?
Wow. I mean, so many reasons. I mean, one is that we never really settled what we think about religion in our founding documents. You know, we have separation of church and state, but at the same time, we have a presence of religion in our public space with military chaplains and prayers in Congress and things like that. So we're always fighting about that. Another is we're fighting about who gets to be included in the nation. You know, are Muslims really part of America? Are Catholics really part of America? Are Mexican immigrants really part of America? Those things have been with us from the start.
What do you mean when you say that it's always the conservatives who start the culture wars?
Well, culture wars, as I see them, are heated battles about moral and religious questions, but they're usually instigated by some kind of sense of loss, which is a classical conservative kind of posture, that some form of life is passing away. That might be a more homogeneous Protestant America. It might be a more homogeneous Judeo-Christian America. It might be the small town. It might be white or patriarchal society. And culture wars begin as protests against that, and then they sort of attach themselves to specific policies. So they're essentially conservative impulses, and the culture wars are then started and then waged disproportionately by conservatives.
You say that they are often won by conservatives.
Well, they're often won by liberals, almost always won by liberals, and that's one of the interesting paradoxes. Is that?
Well, wait a minute. I'm talking about the elections, not the wars.
Oh, right. Well, that's right. So you have the culture wars themselves are instigated on the right and then one on the left. And it sort of makes you think, well, why do conservatives keep doing this? Why keep fighting about same-sex marriage, for example, now when it's settled law and when the polls are showing that Americans are now basically in favor of that? What's the utility? Well, the utility is that you can get people who feel worried about the changes in the society, who feel anxious about the ways in which our society no longer is that sort of homogeneous path that they're holding on to, and they'll vote for you. So there's a way that conservatives sort of win by losing. They win the elections by losing the culture wars.
So before the culture wars are lost and the elections have been won, it would appear then that a lot of people do have a sense of loss about whatever it is that happens to have vanished or appears to be vanishing at a particular time.
That's right. I mean, one of the stories in my book is the ways in which the culture continues to become more and more inclusive over time. It becomes more gender inclusive. It becomes more racially and ethnically inclusive. It becomes more religiously inclusive. So at any given moment, there's people on the edge of that transformation who feel fear and anxiety in the face of it, like a lot of the people who love Donald Trump now, or even the people who love Cruz or Rubio, all three of them culture warriors, are attracted to the ways in which they hark back to the Christian America, to the more patriarchal and alpha male America. And as that past is fading, they are increasingly attracted to these sorts of figures. But it can be really depressing from my perspective, from the perspective of people who wish for a more civil, you know, civil politics. But one of the messages of the book is that we do move through these campaigns. So even though we continue to have culture wars, individual cultural battles come to an end. We're no longer fighting about whether a Catholic can be president or whether a Mormon can be a good American. And pretty soon, I don't think we'll be fighting about whether, you know, gays and lesbians can be, you know, part of the American family.
You seem to be saying that the culture war, by definition, is designed to lose because the changes that are being resisted have already gone so far that it's inevitable they can't be overturned.
Right, because if you think that the emotional resonance, the emotional core of the culture war complaint has to do with the passing away of an old order, that complaint only works. It only resonates in voters and in citizens if you palpably feel that's happening. So if you're complaining about Catholics taking over the country when there's only five Catholics, that's not going to work. But if you complain about Catholics taking over the country when they're up to 10% in Cincinnati or 25% in Boston, then that starts to make more sense. And this is when culture wars typically erupt. That's when they've erupted now around Muslims in America. That's when they erupted in the past around Mormons, around Catholics. And the same goes for the saloon, you know, which is another episode that I look at with prohibition and repeal. You know, a classic case of sort of starting with a complaint about the saloon and then ending with the repeal, the liberty side repeal of prohibition.
How did the saloon get tied into ethnic and nationalistic politics?
Well, the saloon was seen as Irish. It was a place where the Irish Catholics congregated, and the beer that they were drinking was German beer. You know, so it was many things, I argue, but among the things it was a Protestant protest against Catholics in the public space in America. But it was also that was a time when the modernity was really kicking in with industrialization and urbanization and immigration and the migration of African Americans from south to north. And so there was this coming into being of the kind of multicultural America we think of now. And part of the protest of prohibition was more broadly against that kind of multiculturalism in the name of a more homogeneous monoculture of the past.
Can liberals be culture warriors too? What about Bernie Sanders, for example, who wants to go back to the days, he says again and again, when Wall Street wasn't as out of control as it is now? Is that a culture war that he's bound to lose?
Well, I think people on the left can be culture warriors, and in fact, they do fight for their position on abortion, on homosexuality, and on the question of Muslims as being part of the American family. I think we usually associate the Bernie Sanders type issues with kind of ordinary politics rather than cultural politics, right? He's talking about money. He's talking about taxation. I do think there's a cultural element there where there's a protest that working class Americans have of a sense that the society has passed them by. And I think that's where the resonance that Donald Trump has and the resonance that Bernie Sanders have with that population, there's a cultural element to it. But for the most part, the war that Bernie's fighting, I think, is an economic one about economic inequality, and that's the stuff of sort of ordinary and typical politics.
So that's different in kind, then, from what you're talking about when you say culture war.
It is, but I think the thing that makes it tricky nowadays is that we usually think of culture wars as these moral and religious questions, right? I mean, classically, abortion, homosexuality, family values, those kinds of things. But increasingly, the MO, the modus operandi of the culture wars, is migrating over into everything. So we're seeing it with battle over the Supreme Court and Scalia.
Okay.
And we see it over the Bernie Sanders issues as well. It's kind of the fight between good and evil.
Why liberals can win the culture wars even when they lose elections, Stephen Prothero at Boston University. Many thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Oren Alney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.